of the availability of SNAP, so little kids are going to go hungry again, thanks to Republicans. Yeah, and so those of you who have heard me rail against Republicans, I will continue to do so and not vote for them, at least not at the national level. We have some good people in the local level who are moderates, and they really care about the community, and I consider them periodically, but I will never vote for a national Republican. Thank you for listening, and I'm not sure what's up next. Hey, Ty? What's up next? We're not sure what's up next. But we will be going off the air and thanking you for being here. Somewhere my timing was off. Thank you for your patience. Do we have a song?
There's a great and a bloody fight round this whole world tonight. In the battle, the bombs and shrapnel rain. Hitler told the world around he would tear our union down. But our union's gonna break them slavery chains. And our union's gonna break them slavery chains. I walked up on a mountain in the middle of the sky. Could see every farm and every town.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.
Camp KBOO is now in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
We have incredible diversity of mussels here in North America. We have over 300 species. You go to Europe and you've got 24 species. They just don't have the diversity. The reason is because of the Mississippi River and all the diversity that developed with that whole glaciation, unglaciation period, as all the fish diversity, the crayfish diversity, the mussel diversity, the snail diversity is all incredibly huge.
I'm Madison-based author and producer Tamara Dean. Today on Sprouts, we hear how citizen scientists have long led the way in saving endangered freshwater mussels. When someone mentions mussels, the mollusks with a shell like a clam's, your first thought might be seafood. But none of the hundreds of types of native freshwater mussels that live in North America's lakes and streams are the kind you'd find on a menu. They're less familiar, typically hidden in the mud. And now they're disappearing. When Europeans arrived on this continent, freshwater mussels were so abundant that they paved river bottoms. Wading in the Illinois River, for example, would have felt like walking on a tile floor. Now, though, native freshwater mussels are experiencing an apocalypse, according to National Geographic. They're North America's most critically imperiled fauna. In 2021, one-third of the species that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service flagged as presumably extinct were freshwater mussels. That's bad news for our waterways. Barely mobile and filtering gallons of water per day, native mussels are both bellwethers of environmental harm and boosters of water quality. They're especially vulnerable. Their historical losses are legendary, paralleling and exceeding in scale what other species have suffered. You might have heard of zebra mussels, the prolific invasive species that compete with freshwater mussels for resources. But zebra mussels are just one of the many threats native mussels have faced. Dams and man-made river channels curtail the movements of fish that act as hosts for the native mussels' larvae. Runoff from cities, farms, and factories pollutes waterways. Climate change is warming rivers and affecting mussel reproduction, as are waterborne residues of prescription drugs. But of all the threats America's native mussels have faced, the first and most devastating was button making. A century of profiting from freshwater mussels began in 1885 with German immigrant John Frederick Beppel. Back in Germany, he was a button factory manager. Then a friend sent Beppel a box of shells collected from a river 200 miles west of Chicago. He saw the shells as quality raw material, and it would be free. He recognized the economic possibilities. He emigrated and settled near the Mississippi River in Iowa. Soon, Beppel acquired a foot-powered lathe, which he used to cut small round blanks from mussel shells. He drilled holes in the blanks and sold a dozen of his buttons to a dry goods retailer in Muscatine, Iowa. He found an investor, built a factory, attracted business partners, and then built a bigger factory. Locals had ridiculed Beppel for his idea of making buttons from shells, but his success led others to copy him. Within a few years, the Midwestern button trade, centered in Muscatine and serving the world, exploded. There was no limit to the quantity of freshwater mussels a person could take. Tons were dredged from the Mississippi River daily. Fires burned on the riverbanks around the clock as women and children steamed the flesh from the shells. In 1899, a newsman claimed that Beppel, quote, originated an industry that made it possible for some $3 million worth of hitherto valueless product of nature to be disposed of up to date. The reporter continued, but for his intelligent and persevering efforts, millions of mussels would still be resting unprofitably in their beds at the bottom of the river, and thousands of men and women would be seeking other work in the already overcrowded lines of labor. By all accounts, Beppel was hard to get along with. Finally, his business partners took away his Muscatine factory. Beppel fumed, yet persevered. He recognized that a steep decline in mussel populations already underway would impact the shell button trade. He pioneered the first mussel propagation techniques. He designed a tool for harvesting mussels that left young ones behind to keep growing. Still, he was bankrupt and bitter when he died in 1912 at age 57. People were still harvesting freshwater mussels, or clams as they called them, for commercial uses until the late 20th century. The shell button industry that Beppel started collapsed after the Great Depression as the vast supply of mussels dwindled and cheaper, more durable plastic buttons became available. But later, Midwestern mussel shells were exported to Japan and cut into small bits, nuclei to be inserted into oysters' mantles. The oysters secrete chemicals to form layers of nacre, or mother-of-pearl, around the irritants to make cultured pearls. In the early 1970s, Marion Havlick, a nurse from La Crosse, Wisconsin, became a self-taught malacologist, a mollusk expert. She gathered mussels from the giant piles of sand that the Army Corps of Engineers regularly dredged from the Mississippi River to clear shipping lanes. One summer, she found 200 individuals of an endangered species, the Higgins Eye pearly mussel. She wrote to the Army Corps and accused them of violating the new Endangered Species Act. When a colonel responded that he didn't have to abide by the act, Havlick was furious. She sent notices to senators, the DNR, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, environmental organizations, and news outlets. Her campaign led to a congressional inquiry. She earned the nickname That Clam Lady and notoriety as a loud advocate for mussels when few others prioritized their survival. A significant obstacle to saving these creatures was that even few natural resources professionals valued them. Havlick said the prevailing view of mussels at the time was,
they don't have fur, fin, and feathers, And they think of them as being just one of those dumb things that lives on the bottom of the rivers. Well, those dumb things that live on the bottom of the rivers tell us a whole hell of a lot about our rivers, you know.
On the other side of Wisconsin, while Havlick was rescuing endangered mussels from dredged sand, Harold Mathiak was driving to river crossings where Department of Natural Resources crews were emptying drums of poison into the water. Wildlife managers aimed to eliminate undesirable fish such as carp and clear the waters for stocked game fish such as walleye, pike, and bass. But Mathiak knew that the piscicides, antimycin, and rotenone would kill more than the nuisance carp. Freshwater mussels are especially sensitive to toxins. How many would settle into the silt or float downstream, unacknowledged collateral damage? Mathiak was not then a malacologist, but years before, as a biologist with Wisconsin's DNR, he had analyzed muskrat middens, which were filled with mussel shells. And in 1971, he and his co-worker David Bratley were assigned to check mussels after the agency's test treatment of part of the Rock River with antimycin. Other teams investigating the chemical's effects on fish, mammals, birds, and insects found virtually no negative impacts. That was the answer the higher-ups wanted. After Mathiak and Bratley submitted their report showing an 80% mortality rate among mussels in the treated water, Bratley said,
"They tried to discount our research. They said we were wrong, that couldn't be. And it got to a point where they started to ostracize me."
The DNR intended to dismiss their findings and poison the river despite certain mussel annihilation. So, Mathiak delivered their report to Wisconsin's governor at the time, Patrick Lucy. Lucy demanded a 6-month stay on the river treatment until more studies could be conducted. This outraged DNR managers. They turned up the heat on Bratley until he quit and fell into a deep depression. Mathiak retired. No longer a government employee, at age 57, he was free to be an activist. "A bunch of crooks," he called his former employer. The DNR had sold its soul for sporting, had bent to the will of fishermen, he believed, and abandoned its mission of protection. After the 6-month moratorium, despite lawsuits from environmentalists, the agency moved ahead with its plan to treat 2,800 stream miles with antimycin and rotenone. Fueled by anger, Mathiak decided to inventory the state's mussels, dead and alive. He would be an archivist of nature, a chronicler of losses. According to his daughter Lucy, Harold Mathiak was a born scientist, curious, dogged, meticulous, and never lacking a plan. He grew up during the Great Depression in Milwaukee, in a strict German immigrant family. He was shy, maybe because of his missing left arm, the result of accidentally shooting himself while duck hunting as a teen. Before that, he had been left-handed. He trained himself to be right-handed. As an adult, he allowed himself few limitations. He played baseball and tennis, bow-hunted, banded birds in his backyard, hoisted a canoe on top of his station wagon, and paddled it in the water. Like Marion Havlick, Harold Mathiak studied articles and books and befriended experts on mussels. He had business cards printed with the words Wisconsin Clam Project above his name. He devised tools for finding mussels in river bottoms, pitchforks with hardware cloth attached to the backs of their tines. Over 5 years, he drove more than 20,000 miles across Wisconsin, usually alone. He wouldn't dive, but waded into the waterways, no deeper than 4 feet, to collect mussels at 641 sites on 251 rivers or creeks. Mathiak called his searching for mussels forking. He wrote of this work, "By tapping the fork along silt or sand bottoms while walking in a stream, a sharp or even slight resistance was felt upon contact with a mussel. The contact was also heard as a click. The fork was then maneuvered beneath the mussel in order to bring it to the surface. Since nothing can be seen in murky waters, one develops the sensitivity of the blind in detecting even minor contacts with objects in or on the bottom. And like Marion Havlick, Harold Mathiak filled notebooks for years. His field notes begin in June 1973. Had a report that dead clams were very numerous below the dam at the edge of the old Hickory Golf Course. He followed the DNR crews that summer as they moved through the Rock River system, manipulating dams to draw down the water and draining drums of antimycin and rotenone. Mathiak recorded what he learned when he encountered the crews. Said rotenone had been running all night, river all white on east side. Crew was drifting dead carp downstream. Below another dam, the river bottom was littered with thousands of dead clamshells. Many were large specimens. Collected 36 fresh, dead Anodonta grandis and found another 18 which seemed to have some life. I expect most of these to be dead within 10 days. He found hundreds of dead mussels on every visit to a treated waterway. He moved on to untreated waterways. Through the years, he tallied mussels in each of the state's 72 counties. Some of his field notes approach the poetic. Abandoned farm, thunder, vast current. Stony, swift, visibility zero, forking impossible. After poring over his papers, I asked the University of Wisconsin-Madison Zoology Department archivist what it would take to repeat Mathiak's survey today. Technology makes a lot of data collection less expensive, she said, but mussels don't move. They can't be electroshocked or forced into a net like a fish or attracted by a lure. They're like rocks in the stream. Human power is necessary to dig them out. Recreating Mathiak's survey today would be an exorbitant endeavor, virtually impossible. You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm author and producer Tamara Dean, talking about threats and attempts to save North America's endangered freshwater mussels. Ironically, freshwater mussels might have been protected by the zebra mussel invasion that started around 1989. Years earlier, Japanese shell buyers had analyzed the properties of shells from around the world to find the type that would make the best nuclei for cultured pearls. They found nothing better than the mussels from the upper Mississippi River system, where the water's high calcium carbonate makes native mussel shells extra hard. When Japanese buyers learned that zebra mussels might eliminate native mussels, they announced that they would pay top dollar for any and all native mussel shells. Clammers broke the law to supply those buyers. They took smaller shells, they took shells out of season, and they took them from restricted inland waterways. Those flagrant violations prompted a DNR investigation, which showed that clammers had probably been breaking the law for years. The agency responded by jailing shell buyers and shutting down the industry. Marion Havlick opposed the total ban on harvesting freshwater mussels. The DNR could have strictly limited licenses, she believed, and used the license money to fund mussel research. They could have asked ethical clammers to save the flesh from threatened species so scientists could tell if the species were thriving and reproducing or suffering because of pollutants.
Frankly, I was against that. I said that they should limit the number of licenses because whoever had a license had to be able to make a living from it. But on the other hand, if they close this down altogether, the states weren't going to be able to afford to do any studies. And that's just exactly what's happened.
Harold Mathiak, after learning that he wouldn't have complete control over the content if he signed with a publisher, decided to publish his mussel book himself. My intention is to put out a classic as far as Wisconsin natural history is concerned, he wrote to a colleague. He named his publishing house Sandshell Press. He hired a professional photographer and editor. He paid to print thousands of copies. Mathiak included detailed maps and authenticated his distributions. His had been a purposeful, planned study. Since his years in the field, no one has had the time or money to assess the state's mussel population to such an extent. In the fall of 1979, Mathiak published A River Survey of the Unionid Mussels of Wisconsin. In his author photo, he's bald, wearing silver-rimmed glasses, and positioned with his right side facing the camera, making the absence of his left arm less conspicuous. He sits at a table displaying more than a dozen mussel shells, half whole, open, closed. He gazes down through a lighted magnifying lens held in his right hand. He looks timid and wary, as if convinced that the camera should point elsewhere. His former co-worker David Bratley called the book a treasure and kept the copy he bought. Even so, the book didn't sell well. Mathiak continued collecting mussels. But by the mid-1980s, he recognized that his cognitive abilities were declining. He began a handwritten letter to a colleague, "Now you will know more about my troubles," presumably referring to his symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. The letter mentioned his regret over not publishing his data on the endangered Higgins eye mussel. It concluded, "I dropped fieldwork because of a lack of confidence when handling a boat alone." Sometime in the late 1980s, Mathiak told friends that it was costing him too much to store the remaining copies of his book. He was discouraged about the lack of response, the poor sales. He piled the books in his backyard and burned them. Mathiak's mussel report lived on, however. Years later, the Milwaukee Public Museum made it available as a PDF on its website. One commercial clamor-turned malacologist told me he still relies on Mathiak's data to know where the least common species can be found. A biology teacher from northern Wisconsin uses Mathiak's book to compare his students' mussel finds from locations in the St. Croix River with Mathiak's. Harold's daughter, Lucy, recalled,
"Towards the end of his life, I was present with an interview with a doctor. And what my dad talked about is how he had really wanted to make a contribution. He felt like he had really failed. He was so discouraged because he desperately wanted to call people's attention to what he viewed as something that was going to have a very negative impact on our waterways. He put his own money into the book. Nobody picked up on it, and he ended up destroying most of the copies. He died without ever really knowing what a profound difference, that he'd done something important."
In 2016, Wisconsin's DNR began its first ever official survey of the state's freshwater mussels. Biologists cross-reference their recent results with the numbers and types of species found in surveys by Mathiak and Havlick. The DNR's report noted that mussel populations in some waterways, such as the Wisconsin River, were rebounding, probably because late 20th century clean water regulations had reduced pollution there. In other rivers, the Rock River in particular, they found very large declines, and in some locations, no mussels at all. Lizzie Kitchell, who currently heads Wisconsin's Mussel Conservation Program, told me that the 1970s treatments might have knocked back the Rock River population, but the river faces ongoing water quality challenges, such as effluent from sewage treatment plants and agricultural runoff. Kitchell said of Harold Mathiak's work,
"It's wonderful that he documented what he did. We use that as a document all the time, his work in various systems when we're writing grants, because we don't have any other data. You know, we have a spot here, a spot there, a spot there, but we don't have anything to say what used to occur here. It was a great baseline documentation of what was in the various systems. So, especially given that it was just one person out doing that work, it's just phenomenal how much ground he covered."
She used his survey to identify locations for the DNR's survey, but DNR staff couldn't reach all the rivers that he did. Because it's such an enormous task, Kitchell decided in 2009 to enlist citizen water monitors to collect mussel data. That program continues today, with hundreds of people contributing observations from around the state. She said she especially enjoys training citizen scientists.
I don't have to sell mussels. I just tell their story and people go, oh my God, that's amazing. They're just so much more complicated, and they do so many good services, and people just don't realize. They take it for granted. They're just like rocks on the bottom of the river. And when you explain what they do and how they do it and how amazingly complicated their life cycles are, people really appreciate their worth. And it's really neat to see that light come on, and people go, oh my God, I'd never do that. And then they're very interested in it.
A training manual asks volunteers to record much more information than Mathiac did, including GPS coordinates and the type of substrate, say gravel or sand, where a mussel was found. It asks volunteers to upload data to iNaturalist.org, a publicly accessible online database. Kitchell met Mathiac soon after she joined the DNR. She waded rivers with him. After digging some mussels with his fork, she said, he'd flip the fork, catch the mussels, and stuff the ones he wanted to keep in a bag that hung around his neck. She said of Harold,
he was just truly an impressive and a great guy and very knowledgeable and one of the old school naturalist kind of people.
He embodied a passion for mussels that she told me people discover after they understand how beautiful, fascinating, and significant the mollusks are. I thought of Havlik being so improbably enchanted by the species that she was willing to change professions and battle government agencies. It turned out that while Mathiac was collecting data and specimens across the state, the Rock River poisonings that had infuriated him and prompted his work failed to accomplish the DNR's goals. The river's stocked game fish died off faster than the carp. The carp population grew, and the young carp showed greater resistance to the piscicides. When I asked Kitchell if people remember the 1970s Rock River poisonings and their consequences, she said,
it's just long gone, long forgotten. Yeah. It would be good to remind people of that kind of stuff that went on.
In her early 21st century river surveys, Havlik collected many fewer mussels than she had decades before. And she refused to follow state guidelines and put the mussels back where they were found. She moved them to safer locations. Her defiance represents one benefit of being a citizen scientist rather than a government professional. Relying on your judgment, you can do what's best for the species. Citizen scientists needn't cater to sports fishers, as the DNR staff did in the 1970s. They aren't pressured to falsify data if their results don't match their boss's expectations. True, some might bypass standard methods or act according to obsessions or vendettas, but they're free to blaze their own trails, and that freedom can lead to remarkable discoveries or heroic rescues. The number of citizen scientists devoted to mussels keeps growing, as evidenced by the hundreds of Wisconsinites who record their mussel finds in the iNaturalist database. Contributors there learn from each other and offer help with difficult identifications. This, too, is what citizen science allows that formal research doesn't. A shared learning experience, an inclusive approach, and a collaborative contribution to the greater good. In 2023, in the sandy, wide Wisconsin River, hundreds of mussels were stranded on banks or sandbars when a drought caused the river's water to dwindle to historic lows. Dozens of people, including school children, walked the shoreline and tossed surviving mussels into the water, which was only 5 feet away but beyond the mussels' capacity to reach in time to save themselves. Hundreds of mussels, shells gaping, had been stranded too long already and died. Ellen Voss, one of the mussel rescuers, reminded me of the rage that had motivated Havlik and Mathiac.
It makes me so angry, I guess, that, again, we'll call them victims of climate change. Like, they're faced to deal with the situation that they had no part in, and they can't evolve fast enough to adapt to it.
Some of the mussels she was too late to save were the same endangered species that Marion Havlick and Harold Mathiak had fought for. While Voss rescued mussels, she struggled with an existential crisis, she told me. She felt that her efforts were too small to matter, but also that they did matter. She called it the best workday of her year.
Our little personal efforts don't really seem like they're having a big impact, but in this very specific case, like literally your hands are saving a life.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Saving North America's Freshwater Mussels. This show was produced by me, Tamara Dean, author of Shelter and Storm at Home in the Driftless, a collection of true tales of discovery. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference.